Today, more than half of the world's population lives in cities, and it's predicted that by 2030, 60% of the population in China, 87% of Americans, and 92% of residents in the United Kingdom will be city dwellers. Yet, urban inhabitation is a relatively new phenomenon in the timeline of human history. The first cities came into being around 6,000 years ago. The creation of cities was not an inevitability. So why did it happen? In her new book, Cities, the First 6,000 Years, UCLA professor of anthropology Monica Smith explains the rise of the first urban developments and their connections to the cities of today. The book is fascinating. It is Cities, the First 6,000 Years, and we welcome Monica Smith to the roundtable this morning. Monica, thank you very much.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. This book is fascinating. What brought you to want to look in such detail as to this history of cities?
Well, as an archaeologist, I've been fortunate to excavate at a number of ancient city sites, and then I've also been a resident of modern cities, and the two of them have been so similar that gradually I feel that when I work at an ancient city, that I'm really excavating some dusty vestige of my own modern metropolitan experience. There are so many similarities between ancient and modern cities that it made me think about what we could do to understand the modern world by looking at what came before.
You seem that you became very focused on why cities were invented. Why they have persisted despite the challenges that people find in cities.
As you already pointed out, cities are not the natural habitat of our species. Homo sapiens has been around for the last 200,000 years or so, and yet cities are a remarkably, even astonishingly new development in our settlement repertoire. The thing that came before cities that was a kind of precursor or a blueprint for the ability to gather in larger and larger crowds of strangers was the development of ritual centers, including places like Göbekli Tepe, which is in Turkey, or a place that's probably more familiar to us as Stonehenge in England. And those were places where people clearly came together to create something special and to have a fair or a festival or some kind of ceremonial occasion. But at the end of the ceremonial occasion, people were supposed to go home back to their villages. But I think that after a while, that sense of a permanent festival atmosphere was just irresistible to people. And so instead of everybody going home, they would go down to a place where they could have a trading center that gradually became a residential center, where people could also get education, where people could get new types of jobs. And then cities just grew and blossomed incredibly quickly after that.
You touched on this a moment ago, and you write about it in great detail in the book, but it is fascinating because there is a kind of an assumption that the modern world is very different from the past, and that cities of today have far different challenges than cities of 5,000-6,000 years ago. And yet you write that all of the things that were there, they may look different, but all of the things that were there as far as dealing with people and dealing with people and what they do in their everyday lives were something that cities were dealing with long, long ago.
Yes, absolutely. In terms of physical form, the things that we have in cities now, like a concentrated downtown and infrastructure of streets or canals or bridges, those open spaces where people can have gatherings, parades, festivals, and also occasionally riots, are things that we can see in ancient cities. So the physical parts are very similar, but the social parts are also very much the same. You've got wealthy people, and you've got very poor people, and then you've got a category of people in between. You've got a kind of thriving middle class that is engaged in professional salaried employment. There's a value on education, on training, and there's also a concentration of arts and entertainment. Think about where the largest museums and sports stadiums are in our own cities, and that's exactly where you'll find them in the ancient downtowns as well.
Mm. You point out in the book that there's a risky quality to then and now of living in a city.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that we do as city dwellers is that we are constantly dealing with strangers, whereas in village environments, people were always familiar. And then another thing that we deal with is the fact that we don't know where our next meal is coming from. That is something that is very different from village life. In village life, you know where your next meal is coming from because the cow is right there, the supply of grain is right there, you can see your field right outside your window. But all of that is stuff that people give up when they move into urban environments. So there's a kind of trust that when you want something to eat, you'll be able to get it at a store or at a vendor or a street stall or something like that. And that is a huge leap of faith. But it's also what makes cities resilient and sustainable as a kind of ironic contrast to this dependency on others, because we know that cities can draw from a vast hinterland of potential resource zones. We can see this archaeologically. For example, I have a colleague, Jason Ur, who is now a Harvard professor, who looks at the way in which ancient cities had not just one or two roads leading into them, but many, many different roads, like a radial spoke and wheel system that drew in wheat and barley and sheep and goats and cattle from a very, very large area, which is exactly the way in which our own modern cities draw in a huge network of diverse sources of supply. When you look at the food in your grocery store, when you look at those little tiny stickers on the apple that you might be about to buy, you have to look carefully to see, like, where did it come from? Maybe it came from Belgium. Maybe it came from New Zealand. Maybe it came from your own home state. But that apple is ready for you to buy when you need it.
When it comes to the city and I guess even its when we compare it to ancient cities, I mean, one of the points that you make is that we will always have a need. There doesn't seem to be anything in us that says that we are going to shy away from urbanism.
No, and in fact, the growth of cities is going to continue, even though many cities are already huge. I mean, think about a place like Mexico City, which is about 21 million people. Tokyo is about 39 million people. And in every city in the world, there are objectively difficult conditions for people to move into. Think about cities like, you know, Rio or Jakarta, where there are large populations of people living in slums. So people know that conditions will be objectively difficult, but you still cannot keep people out of cities, especially young people, because they believe that things are going to be better, even if they have to pass through some difficult conditions in order to be able to get a job or to get some education in the city.
You do write in the book quite a bit about gentrification, and something that you point out has been happening for thousands of years. Give us a sense of gentrification in the past and what we see today.
Well, one of the things about archaeology is that in the past, people did not get rid of buildings quite as thoroughly as we do now. If there's a building we don't like now, we can get a bulldozer and just scrape it away. But in ancient cities, it was more convenient and efficient to just kind of flatten out the older stuff and then build right on top of it. So this is how we can dig down through these archaeological layers and look at the evolution and development of cities. I have a colleague, Andrew Dufton, who has done a really nice job of looking at gentrification in Roman cities, where in one generation you can see that there is a whole variety of small houses together in a neighborhood, and in the next generation somebody comes through and wipes out half of them to put up a great big mansion. So these opportunities, temptations of having differential housing and having wealth differentials show up in architecture is definitely not something new. It's something that has been present in cities, you know, pretty much from the beginning.
When you're looking at this growth in a city, because it there's always seems to be the want to make whatever we have better, right? So there is a point where you're looking to have, we can call it anything we want, of keeping up with the Joneses, and that, I mean, that is a having to do with a house, but even in a city size skyscraper, it's something that you'll say, oh, okay, this is something that we don't have a use for this building, but let's do something that will bring us to the future. That always seems to be a goal for cities.
Yes, absolutely. The way that we deal with our architecture means that in some sense we are constrained by the buildings that are all around us. As the architect Jeremy Till has talked about, the phenomenon of architectural dependence is when you do remove that building with a bulldozer, you have the same lot that you started with, and you're not going to be able to remove the adjacent buildings in most cases in order to be able to do something new. But what a canvas of opportunity for creating new architecture. Or in cases where you want to do something new, maybe you don't even have to take the building out. You can repurpose a structure to be a different kind of use. And that sense of an accelerated creativity, you know, not only about architecture, but portable goods and open spaces and transportation, means that we can constantly reimagine something that is better than what we had before, including addressing problems like poverty or social justice through simple things like, where do the new transportation hubs go? How can people be served by the new transportation infrastructure? How can we equalize opportunities to education and employment through the ways that we design our cities?
When it comes to that idea, I mean, we're still having this discussion. I mean, Mayor de Blasio of New York yesterday said he wants to ban glass and skyscrapers. What is that, do you think, a sign of?
It's a sign that we're trying to address many problems at once using the same canvas of the city. And every time that there is something new that goes in, it has both admirers and detractors. There are, for example, ancient cities where we can see construction types that were then hidden behind the facades of renovated buildings so that something that was fashionable or necessary at one point of time, like the Pyramid of the Feathered Serpent at the site of Teotihuacan in Mexico, that had its facade changed because the decoration probably struck some people as being too over the top. So these are not new considerations. What we have is the technological capacity that then results in kind of philosophical or social questions about how we want a place to look and how we want people to be able to interact in those spaces. So this dialogue between technology and capacity and also cost, finances, and funding, these are not new questions. These have come about since the very beginning as well.
So we will always have zoning law fights.
Exactly. There are always different visions about what a place should be used for, you know, and even something like gentrification, which you've already mentioned, is something that from the perspective of some people is advantageous because it brings in jobs, it brings in people with capacity to support service industries, it builds a kind of community in places that can then accelerate the kinds of education and other entertainment opportunities that we like as part of cities. So to some people, the idea of gentrification is a positive. And then, of course, to some communities, gentrification is a negative because it threatens to undermine the community that they already have. So yes, we are always going to have these zoning discussions. Everyone has the same thing in mind, is how do we make this better?
The name of the book is Cities, the First 6,000 Years. The book is published by Viking. Monica Smith, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure as well.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Monica Smith is a professor of anthropology and professor at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at the University of California, Los Angeles. The new book is Cities, the First 6,000 Years. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.